It's the 7th of September 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: where does the new Green Party leader, Natalie Bennett, stand on science? What's the point in government reshuffles, other than to, I guess, reward a job that's poorly done? Is Simon Singh's New Society not just about good thinking, but a good idea in practice too? Why are IQ tests actually a pretty good idea? And would the likes of you understand? But first, the traditional begging slot. Now, if you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do head over to our website and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. And also, don't forget, there is only 1 week to go now until our big birthday event on the 15th of September at Conway Hall in central London. It's going to be a cracking lineup. We've got Kate Russell from BBC Click, Alom Shahar, author of The Young Atheist Handbook, not talking about the book, but performing some magic. We've got fire scientist Claire Benson doing stuff with fire, and we've got Martin Robbins from The Guardian getting a bit angry, amongst many other things. So do come down. You can get your tickets. They're only a fiver from our website at poddelusion.co.uk. So now on with the show. And we start this week with something of a massive coup. On Monday, the Green Party elected its new leader, Natalie Bennett, who is replacing Caroline Lucas as the head of the party. Now, many of our left-leaning listeners are probably a lot like me, you know, broadly sympathetic to the Green Party's politics in terms of needing to do something about climate change and their approach to economics and other issues, but are a bit scared off by them being a bit nutty when it comes to science issues. For example, you may remember that back in May this year, we covered the anti-genetic modification protests at Rothamsted, where they were carrying out some trials. The protest, in which campaign group Take the Flower Back threatened to destroy the research, was strongly backed by Jenny Jones, who was the Green Party's London mayoral candidate, and still is one of the most high-profile people in the party. So a few months on, and now that Natalie Bennett has taken the reins, is anything going to change? Somewhat unbelievably, last Wednesday I got a chance to sit down with Natalie and ask her about some of these issues and about the party and what she plans to do more generally. So I'm here with Natalie Bennett, the brand new leader of the Green Party. Natalie, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Was it a surprise when you won? I looked at the numbers and you did seem to sort of thrash everyone else a bit.
I certainly wouldn't put it like that. We're the Green Party. We have a nice collegiate, friendly competition. The final vote was, there was about 500 votes difference, so it was fairly clear cut, I think. But, you know, I don't know. We haven't had a contest in the Green Party not involving Caroline Lucas before, so it was a new experience. We didn't really know what would happen.
I guess the first and obvious place to start is, what are your ambitions for your leadership, and what do you hope to achieve?
I basically want to make the Green Party a national party. I want to see that everyone across England and Wales, the Scottish Party is separate for those who are wondering why I'm not mentioning Scotland, that everyone has at least one elected Green representative, either on their local council or as a European MEP in Brussels. And if we can do that in the next couple of years, and certainly by the end of the decade, then we'll also be in a great position to win many more MPs in Westminster.
Isn't that aiming a bit small? I mean, I asked our contributors for ideas and someone said, you said something similar to this in The Guardian, I think. Said, can you aim a bit higher? The Lib Dems are doing terribly.
Well, what we've got is a realistic target for the next 2 years. And there's been a lot of talk about how, you know, we can collect Lib Dem voters. But there's one terrible problem with that. There's not that many Lib Dem voters to start off with, even in their good days.
Do you see your role now as the leader of, you know, I don't want to sound offensive, but I don't think there's going to be a Green majority at the next election. So do you see yourself as more of a sort of Prime Minister in waiting sort of leadership role, or more of like a leader of a pressure group? I mean, how do you sort of...
No, I mean, the Green Party works by getting people elected, and you know, we're running our first council in Brighton, albeit as a minority administration. We're not very far off running Norwich. We are in a position where we can do things, where we can make a difference. And, you know, as we saw in Australia, where one Green MP is part of a very fragile coalition government. You know, you don't need to have, you know, huge numbers. You know, I'd love to be able to say, yes, we're going to elect 100 MPs in 2015. That's probably not realistic. You never know what might happen. But what we need to do is build up the strength of the Green Party, build up the membership of the Green Party, make sure that people see that, yes, we can elect Greens, the vote can make a difference. Because with the first past the vote post-electoral system in Britain, it's very difficult to get through that first barrier. And now we have got through that first barrier with Caroline in Westminster. Who knows what's possible?
Given Caroline is still this very central figure in the party, as she's the MP, how is this going to affect the dynamic of your leadership? I mean, whilst you're leader, I imagine she's still going to carry a lot of influence, and if she says something, you're going to have to, you know, agree with her.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. The Green Party very much believes in freedom of conscience anyway. But basically, you know, it's not a competition between Caroline and I. We can work together very much so. Caroline will still be, obviously, very often the public face of the Green Party, and that's absolutely fine. What I'm doing is really providing an additional face. You know, we're building up our resources in all sorts of areas, in fundraising, in membership, in supporters. You know, this is another way in which we're building up our capacity as the Green Party to get out there and put our message out there more.
At the next election, I mean, do you think you can add, how many would you care to speculate now on how many you'd like to add and so on?
I'm not going to speculate on the political state in 2015, because that's a long way away. You know, a week is a long time in politics. That's an age. But I think, you know, what we want to do is identify as soon as possible 10 target seats around the country, and we want to be in there as serious players in those 10 seats. And, you know, if we get to that point, who knows what will happen after that. But we've got to build the infrastructure, build the resources, be getting the newsletters out, be doing the work on the ground. People can see us there. From there, we can see where we build to.
I was reading your leadership document before, and you were talking about how you were going to, it sounded fascinating from a sort of politics nerd point of view, about the West Midlands model of campaigning, because I understand that in 2010, the reason you won in Brighton was because basically everything was thrown at Brighton. If you want to win more places in 2015, I mean, what's the plan?
Okay, well, the West Midlands model, there's some great examples of how effective that's been, in that they've moved from three councillors on three councils to 13 on seven councils in 2 years. And the way they've done that effectively is by working as a team. So rather than each local party just going its own way and deciding what it wants to do, and, you know, the Green Party is a very localism-based institution. Local parties decide their own course. You know, the central party doesn't tell them what to do. We don't have a sort of Tony Blair, the messages going out on the pages. Remember those, for those who are old enough to remember that. But what we do is we want to make sure that those parties get the support and the help they need. So the whole West Midlands is working as a team, and that's what the West Midlands model is, really.
So thinking about you and the party now, I mean, you've obviously been elected by, I guess, a majority of the voters in the party. But can you perceive any, I expect any sort of clause 4 moment equivalent? Do you have any views which are currently divergent from the party at large? Or?
No, I mean, there's no major issue that I've got any difference on. I mean, like any political party, I'm sure you could pick out one sentence of the policies for a sustainable society that I wouldn't agree with. But in general, you know, I'm very comfortable with where we are. And, you know, the Green Party doesn't whip. The Green Party allows divergent views, and if there is something that comes up that I disagree with the party line on, all I need to do is to say, well, my personal view is that, but the party line's that, and the party has no problem with that.
I think that's one thing that the I guess the public perception of the Greens is still very much a one-issue thing. If you think of the Green Party, you think of sort of environment and things like that.
Right, that's very much not our stance. We've never been a single-issue party. We may sometimes appear that through the filter of the media, who often only wants to talk to us about climate change and such issues. But the fact is, the Green Party's always had policies on education, on health, on science, on you know, and particularly relevant now on economics. We have an idea of a whole different kind of economic model, a society that works very differently, not the neoliberal outsourcing privatisation kind of model we have now, but very much having publicly owned and publicly run services and all the things like the NHS. We believe in terms of the business economy that we don't want, you know, a few globalised multinationals supplying everything. If you think about supermarkets, the Tesco and Sainsbury's model, what we very much prefer is small local businesses and cooperatives serving their local community, drawing their resources from the local community, providing jobs in the local community. So we have an idea of a very different economic model that's different to the other three larger parties, and that really, you know, is a chance to say we want to rebuild Britain that provides a more secure future, more jobs, more certainty about the future, and is also preparing us for the low-carbon world, because, you know, we're not going to be able to keep flying peas in from Peru and beans from Kenya and all the rest of it. That's all got to stop. We've got to relocalise our farming, relocalise our food supplies, all of those sorts of things. And that means a complete transformation of all of British society and economy.
Not too ambitious a plan, then.
Well, Actually, I'd say it's very ambitious. And, you know, given the fact that the current economic model has given us the unhappiest children in the whole of the developing world, given us huge levels of mental ill health and stress, you know, we need to take a new direction and we need to take it fast.
Do you think on the environment point, it's tackling the problems with the environment, which are obviously at the forefront of the party's concerns, do you think it has to be linked to changing how, you know, how capitalism works, how the rest of society works? Because I imagine a lot of people listening will be thinking, no, I think we should do something about climate change and, you know, about problems with the environment. But at the same time, I don't want to have to buy into the lifestyle that comes with it, if you see what I mean.
Well, I mean, you know, if you mean by lifestyle, the sort of thing we're talking about is making sure you live in a well-insulated, draft-proof home so that your fuel bills are less and therefore your carbon emissions are less. You know, that's a lifestyle most people would be pretty comfortable with. Some nice fresh food in the local shop that tastes like it came out of the ground yesterday, because it did, not like it's been in some supermarket's cold store for the last 6 months. That might be quite a nice thing. You know, a feeling that you actually know where the next week's rent's coming from, that you're not, you know, living in a private rental accommodation with no security, you can be chucked out at any time. All of those kind of things are the sort of things that we'd like to tackle and change. And, you know, that's the sort of lifestyle I think a lot of people would really like to see.
I sent a message out to our listeners and our contributors saying, what do people want to know about, given that you're now the leader of the party? And we've got essentially a laundry list of things.
All right, I'll try and answer them quickly to fit them all in.
We'll start with the most contentious. We've got a lot of people very interested in your stance on nuclear power. Now, I understand that you're strongly against it.
Very much so. It's very much party policy, strongly against it. And I think there's so many reasons to argue against it, but my personal belief is that it's an utter distraction. The key reason of all is that a distraction from investment and focus on the renewables that we actually need to, you know, the wind, the solar, the other potential renewables that are already there as a mature technology and are proven. That, you know, is one absolutely key issue. Whatever we're talking about nuclear, what we're talking about is a very, very expensive form of energy, a very uncertain form of energy. In that, you know, they've been trying to build some nuclear power plants around the world that are vastly behind schedule. You know, you've always got huge planning problems. It takes a very long time to bring on stream. It's simply not the answer for the current situation. And, of course, there are the safety issues as well.
Do you understand, or can you sympathise with the argument that it could be a pragmatic solution? Because if climate change, you know, we keep hearing about scientists saying we need to do something about climate change now. Is that not a more pragmatic solution to, rather than waiting for a much bigger shift which is needed, you know, to get everyone to behave differently and to change everything else? Is building a few nuclear plants, basically, that's a lot easier, isn't it?
It sounds a lot easier. Just click your fingers and solve the problem. It's like that's what they did in the sort of 50s science cartoons where all sort of magical things happen just by saying science, the word science. But the fact is that, you know, it takes an absolute minimum of 5 years to build a nuclear power plant. It takes an awful lot less time to put up a wind turbine. And, you know, you're going to have lots of resistance from local people pretty well anywhere you want to put that nuclear power plant. Nuclear power plants often go offline for long periods of time and uncertainty. It's simply not a reliable, certain, or quick way of dealing with a problem where we desperately need to be acting now and getting started on dealing with it now.
Okay, but given we have to then, given that the Greens do only have at the moment one MP, you know, aren't the hugest party, if we're going to sell the idea of tackling climate change to the Tories and people on the right, do we not need... Is nuclear not the way to do that? At least again, to do something to solve the problem, and then we can worry about the implications of that?
No. I think the Tories, well, you'd like to see that they'd see sense on climate change, but I don't think there's a lot of evidence that that's happening.
Okay, so out of the frying pan then, and into the GM fire.
But
obviously, recently we've seen Jenny Jones, the Green mayoral candidate, come out very strongly supporting Take the Flower Back, who wanted to smash up the... Rothamsted's experiments. I mean, what's your take on genetic modification?
Well, I should perhaps say at the start of this, my first degree is agricultural science, so that's where I come to from this. And, you know, I think that GM crops and the release of GM crops into the environment is the wrong way to go, because the fact is GM crops, as currently instituted, represent a further expansion of industrial agriculture, enormous scale corporate agriculture, that's just utterly the wrong direction to be going in terms of the future of farming that we need. You know, I have a particular obsession with soils, and you know, we're utterly trashing the planet's soils, and soils are absolutely critical and it's essential, and we barely understand what's going on with them, and we can't replace them easily. And you know, huge industrial scale agriculture that's just ploughing across the landscape in huge fields. that relies on a few very small handful of seed companies who don't allow farmers to save their own seeds. You know, it's an entirely the wrong model of agriculture. So GM, for me, is tied up with an entirely wrong model of agriculture and is entirely the wrong way to go. And there are, you know, safety concerns in terms of the risk factors of what you could be releasing without really understanding what you're doing.
I was at the Take the Fly Back protest when it happened. I saw the other side of the protest as well. And also, a few days prior to that, I had a tour around Rothamsted with Sense About Science, who a group who promotes science and so on. And the distinct impression I got was that the scientists, you know, what they were doing was relatively safe. The takeaway from the protest I got was, you know, everyone was moaning about Monsanto and the corporations, and I'm thinking, I agree with that, but I just don't think we should smash up the experiment. I mean,
but the thing is, I mean, the nature of that experiment was you were letting loose something into the environment. You know, there'd been experiments in greenhouses that no one had problems with, but as soon as it's a genie that once you let it out of the bottle, it's out there. And, you know, I know the scientists were claiming that, you know, there was a very, very, very tiny chance of cross-contamination, but actually there were some other figures produced from different peer-reviewed papers published in journals that said the figures were, you know, a considerable order of magnitude higher than they were saying. And there simply wasn't the evidence that this was necessary or pointing us in a direction that was useful.
So would you align yourselves with Take the Flower Back? Do you think they would, if they had succeeded in smashing the experiment up, do you think they were doing the right thing?
Yes.
Oh, and one additional point. I actually got an email from one of the scientists at Rothamsted with a question, which I said I'd put directly to you, if that's okay.
Yep.
So I'll read it out. It says, agriculture uses land, energy and other natural resources. With increasing demand for foods and other agricultural products, its environmental impact will increase. To avoid this, improved crops that give better yield using fewer resources like pesticide, fertiliser and water could help. How could the Greens and GM science folks find a way to dialogue so that case-by-case applications of GM could be evaluated to environmental benefits?
I think, you know, I'd certainly be very happy to talk to them, and I think, you know, I've got the foundation that I think we could talk the same language, and I'm always happy to talk to scientists and with people of goodwill who are coming from a place where they want to solve the sort of problems he's talking about. You know, what I'd sort of say is, you know, is that plant breeding is terribly important, but there's also issues of the way you manage the land, the way you ensure that you haven't got soil erosion. There's huge numbers of issues that simply aren't being tackled, and that focus simply on plant breeding, you know, it comes from a very strong focus, a commercial focus.
So that's GM. And another issue which very popular on Twitter yesterday, actually, not because of you but because of Jeremy Hunt, and that is of course of homeopathy.
Yep.
He's now the health secretary. He supports homeopathy. I was wondering, I don't know, maybe perhaps unfairly, perhaps accurately, the perception of the Greens is a little bit, I don't want to say hippie-ish, that's probably a bit rude, isn't it? But, you know, homeopathy sort of...
I don't think hippie's an insult, actually. That's fine. It's just a lifestyle.
But, you know, I mean, homeopathy sort of goes along with that. I mean, what's your personal take on it, and particularly in terms of its place being funded by the NHS as it currently is?
Okay, well, I absolutely do not believe that homeopathy works as they describe it. I think it's a scientific nonsense. However, what I do believe in is the placebo effect. And if you look at, you know, there's literally millions of medical trials that have found that the placebo effect works very well. You know, lots of drugs struggle to get a better than placebo result so they can get approved. Now, what I think, the way I think homeopathy, I'm putting this in quote marks for those who can't see my fingers, works, is that it works for some people as a placebo. And I think there is a place, a very small and limited place within the NHS for homeopathy, because, and while it's within the NHS, it's controlled. If a person has been through, you know, every other form that conventional medicine can offer, every other treatment, they've been tested to make sure they haven't got cancer or something else, like, you know, that needs to be treated with chemotherapy or whatever, and as a last resort you go and say, well, try some homeopathy, and that person believes in it and trusts in it, and you're relying on the placebo effect and it works, there may be some cases where that is actually the best treatment. It's a sophisticated, you know, it requires you to think beyond a straight biochemical understanding of the human body to understand that psychology is part of medicine, and I think it is.
But is it not dangerous in the sense that we've then got people who wear NHS badges saying, you know, try this? Is it not a dangerous precedent to have for non-evidence-based treatments available on the NHS?
Well, I think the thing is that I think for some conditions, and the problem is, of course, that medical trials are almost invariably funded by the pharmaceutical industry, so these trials are never done. For some types of conditions and some circumstances, if you did a double-blind trial of homeopathy, because of the placebo effect, you might get a 30 or 40% cure or you know, substantial improvement in condition rate. You might get, you know, better results than you get for lots of medicines for certain kind of conditions. But no one's done those tests. And what you would be testing is placebo. But you know, there's a problem, and the science needs to think a lot more about how we can take advantage of the placebo effect, because it's very powerful.
Interesting. Our audience are going to love that. So, I mean, I guess then the other thing is, what about other sorts of alternative therapies, chiropractic, Reiki? I mean, why not have someone waving their magic hands over someone on the NHS if that has a similar effect?
I mean, what I'd like to see is it all be based on science. And I think, you know, there are some trials that show some kinds of acupuncture do work for reasons we don't understand. If you've got a trial that shows it works, I'd like to see those trials done for homeopathy, but I don't know who's going to fund them. But I'd like to see the trial done, and if it's shown that it works, but only if, then why not?
Okay. and now we've got some other presumably less controversial things to ask you about. Recently published, there was the Geek Manifesto by Mark Henderson, which basically called for more science in politics, more scientists to get involved. You've got a science degree yourself. How do you think we can encourage this?
I think we desperately do need to get more people encouraged in science, but we also need to improve the scientific literacy of the general population so that people can understand the science more. And we'd really like to, and speaking as a former journalist myself, I don't quite know how you achieve this, but greatly improve the quality of science reporting would be a huge improvement. But, you know, I'd urge any scientist out there who, you know, is thinking, I don't like the way things are being run now, and I don't think policy is based on evidence enough and all of those sorts of things, the short answer is get involved in politics yourself. And that's what we desperately needs to happen. We need a lot more people with a science background. That means you, whoever it is you who are listening to this now, you should get involved.
So can you see a place for sort of randomised control trials in policy?
Very much so, definitely. I mean, you know, the Green Party policy has what's often considered a very controversial policy in terms of drug legalisation and in terms of sex work, and both of those are based, I think, on very strong evidence bases.
Excellent. And these probably sound quite obtuse to you, but these are what people want to know about. So.
I will do my best.
So, sort of issues of digital rights and the Digital Economy Act, for instance. I mean, what's your take on it? Do you think it should be three strikes and you're out for pirates?
Absolutely not. I don't claim to be an expert on this, but I support the open rights group and the general approach that says, you know, the internet is out there, it's now a public service, and it should be available to everybody.
Excellent. And equal marriage, I'm assuming we're all on the same page, aren't we?
Absolutely, equal marriage, and I'm also quite keen on equal civil partnerships.
Excellent. And what's your faith schools and sort of ongoing debate between sort of secularism and religion in public life?
Well, I mean, the Green Party doesn't believe there should be any government funding of private schools, which would include faith schools. So what the Green Party believes in is ideally all schools will be publicly funded, publicly run. And, you know, one of the things I'm personally very passionate about is I think that sex education is wholly inadequate, and we need much better sex and relationship education in schools, and no school should be allowed to opt out of that.
Actually, funnily enough, you should mention that, because I saw on your website you had some fascinating policies on women's rights and around abortion and so on. On your website, you say you want a national rape crisis hotline.
Exactly, that's right. I mean, there's lots of wonderful local services now that provide, because of funding, only limited services. You know, they're typically open a couple of evenings a week and half a weekend or something. We'd like to see the Green Party a national rape crisis hotline that's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whenever anyone's at a point of crisis and they need help. And that wouldn't replace the local services, but it would be a referral point and ensure that people have emergency help when they need it.
And also intriguingly, I thought, you want MPs to job share? So they for childcare, I assume?
Well, not just childcare. I mean, that's what people focus on. Yeah. But, you know, in our society, we have elder care. We were talking about getting people involved in science. Let's imagine it would be good to have some more doctors involved, but they mightn't necessarily want to give up. You know, if you went away from medicine and became an MP for 5 years, it might be quite hard to go back. Mm. You might want a job share with someone else and still keep your hand in by working 2 days a week as a doctor, for example. If we have MPs who have, you know, real lives, real places in the community, are really in touch, and we open the job of MP up to a wider range of people, whether they're carers, whether they're people who want to stay as doctors, whatever it is, you know, if we have people who have more balanced lives as MPs, then that would be extremely healthy.
So would you job share your job as leader? If Caroline Lucas said, do you want to be an MP half the time, leader half the time, and I'll do the same?
actually, the Green Party, the Constitution does allow for co-leaders. And that might have happened, and it wasn't an idea I was opposed to, but in the circumstances of this particular election, that didn't work out.
And we've actually got a question sent in. Backtracking
talking slightly, from Education for Choice, the sex education charity. Yep. And it says, so, would the Green Party consider putting decriminalisation of abortion into your manifesto?
I mean, we already have the strongest pro-abortion rights policy of any party in terms of removing the two-doctor rule, allowing it to be abortions where appropriate to be performed by nurses, and basically all the things that the campaigners want. I think, yes, decriminalisation is certainly something we should look at. That's my personal view.
Excellent. And I think that's actually all of the topics I had written down. So I'll let you get some lunch. Natalie Bennett, good luck with your leadership. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, earlier this week was David Cameron's first reshuffle, or as he calls it, seemingly randomly picking names from a hat and letting them do the job it says, even if they're essentially incompetent. So now we have Jeremy Hunt as the Health Secretary. I know the Health Secretary is essentially all about looking after the human body, but it's not all about arseholes. We also have, rather bewilderingly, Baroness Vazi becoming the Minister for Faith and Communities. Those militant secularists are going to be furious when they hear this. I'm half expecting to, within days, see a grainy video on Al Jazeera featuring humanists threatening to, I don't know, write letters or something. Anyway, this sort of makes you wonder something. Not, what dirt does Hunt have on Cameron that allowed him to get that promotion in the first place, but actually, what the hell is the point in reshuffles anyway? So this week, Corey Hazlehurst is going to explain exactly that. Incidentally, on next week's show, we're going to be reshuffling the Pod Delusion, and Corey is going to be our new celebrity gossip correspondent. So tune in next week when he'll be telling us about which female celebrities look slightly fatter than they did before. Here's Corey with more.
I have resolved to speak about reshuffles this week, without using that awful turn of phrase that everyone is using to describe them. You know the one I mean. The one about rearranging furniture on a supposedly unsinkable ship. I also don't want to talk about the implications of the current reshuffle. It's true that there are many talking points, and a fair amount of grim humour, to be found in a government which appoints a health secretary who approves of homeopathy, a transport secretary who's scared of flying, and an equalities minister who's voted against gay rights. But in this piece, I'll stick to talking about the bigger picture surrounding government reshuffles. On the surface, there's something fairly illogical about the whole concept of a government reshuffle. What's the point of rotating ministers after only a year or two in a position, just at the point at which they'd be acquiring some expertise in their role? If you're an academic in, say, zoology, you wouldn't be packed off to English literature or some other department just because the Vice-Chancellor wanted to send a message to the press. This government has, to be fair to them, been rather sedate when it came to reshuffles. The only cabinet changes they've made so far have been enforced ones, to replace a cabinet minister who's left because of a scandal, such as Chris Hughne or Liam Fox. Another reason reshuffles seem so illogical is because they seem to take place in such a haphazard, slapdash fashion. Whilst he was talking to a man he was about to make a minister in the Number 10 study, Harold Wilson realised that he was meeting with the wrong Mr. Jones. He offered the man he was meeting a ministerial post anyway. There's another farcical example told by Chris Mullin in his diaries about Tony Blair's reshuffle after the May 2005 election. When it was realised that there were no women ministers in the newly formed Department of Industry, Productivity and Energy, Meg Munn was quickly added to the department. Unfortunately, since the ministerial allocation was used up, there was no money to pay her salary. Chris Mullin added that this was not the first time such an instance had happened. It doesn't really fill you with confidence, does it? Tony Blair did become famous for his constant tinkering and reshuffling of ministers. John Reid, for instance, held 7 different cabinet roles in 9 years. But Blair was hardly the first Prime Minister to be guilty of the practice. Let's take a look, for instance, at transport. A quite important department, and the minister responsible for transport gets a cabinet position. Have a guess at how many transport ministers we've had since the Second World War. Patrick McLoughlin, the transport minister scared of flying, who I mentioned earlier, is the 45th transport minister since 1945. That's right, we've had 45 different ministers responsible for transportation policy in 67 years. Each minister, therefore, has an average tenure of just under 18 months. How can there be any sort of integrated, well-thought-out, long-term transportation policy in these circumstances? One possible answer to that is that the civil service runs the show instead. That'll be an obvious explanation for anybody who's watched the excellent television series Yes Minister. Dan Hannan, the Conservative MEP, wrote a blog for The Telegraph earlier this week saying that the reshuffle proved that Sir Humphrey was running the show. Except that the civil service has very high turnover rates as well. Over half the permanent secretaries in charge of governed departments weren't in post before the May 2010 election. The Institute for Government has found that the turnover rates for civil servants in departments such as the Treasury and the Cabinet Office are as high as 30%. A staff survey in the Financial Times reported that 12% of staff working in the Treasury wanted to leave the department as soon as possible. These staff members will move both outside the civil service and to other government departments. In an article in February, the Institute for Government also found that the longest-serving, high-ranking civil servant in the communities and local government team joined the department just before the election. Every other high-ranking civil servant had been in the department for less time than the ministers. Ministers have long complained that civil servants don't remain in post long enough to see policies through, and this churn of civil servants has only been exacerbated by the cuts to government departments and the reductions to civil servants in those departments. Despite the slapdash, illogical method of reshuffling personnel in government, does it lead to an improvement in performance? Research undertaken in areas outside politics, collated in an excellent blog by economist Chris Dillo, indicates that constantly changing managers does not lead to such an improvement in performance. A study of heart surgeons by Robert Hookman and Gary Pisano found that, and I quote, "The quality of a surgeon's performance at a given hospital improves significantly with increases in his or her recent procedure volume at that hospital, but does not significantly improve with increases in his or her volume at other hospitals." So in other words, a surgeon's level of performance can't just be magically transplanted from one hospital to another. Huckman and Pisano suggest that this might be due to the familiarity a surgeon has with the assets of a particular organisation, such as his or her relationships with colleagues. Boris Groysberg, in his book Chasing Stars, argues that the performance of equity managers declines after they change firms. Academics have also conducted research into whether football teams sacking their manager and replacing him with a new one had any impact on team performance. Two separate studies into Italian and Belgian football teams found that the improvement in team performance after sacking a manager was statistically insignificant when one considered that sacking the manager was probably due to a dip in team performance in the first place. It's also insignificant when you compare it to other football teams who had not sacked their manager in the same period. As an embittered fan of Oldham Athletic, a team who was still languishing in League One after appointing 15 managers in 15 years, I can confirm that research is probably true from years of bitter experience. So why do we have reshuffles at all? Often there will be some genuine dead wood to prune and some talented backbenchers to promote. And as Chris Dillo said, having reshuffles makes it more likely that backbenchers will remain loyal to the government in the hope of one day rising up the ministerial ladder. It can also send signals to the party and the press about the direction of the government. An example of this from the current reshuffle is replacing Ken Clark, a more liberal member of the cabinet, with Chris Grayling, who's seen as a more hardline right-winger, at the Department of Justice. This is one of the main reasons why this reshuffle is seen as a realignment of the government to the right. Although perhaps most importantly, reshuffles gives political geeks like me something to talk about. This was Corey Hazelhurst for The Pod Delusion.
There was intriguing news in the world of scepticism this week when science writer, libel hero and friend of the show Simon Singh launched a new charity that aims to, quote, encourage curiosity and promote rational thinking. Sounds intriguing, but obviously being a rationalist, I wanted some evidence that the Good Thinking Society will do what its website claims, which is why earlier on I caught up with both Simon Singh and the charity's chief operating officer and former Pod Delusion contributor, Johnny Shannon, to find out more.
I guess, first of all, what is the Good Thinking Society all about?
I often have odd ideas, and the problem is trying to find a home for them, or trying to find time to do them. So the idea behind Good Thinking was to set up a little hub where if I have a pet project, I can find a home for it. And if other people have ideas, they can bring them to good thinking. And Johnny and I will try and make them happen. Really, it's just a low-key, small hub for ideas and skepticism that need a home.
So the slogan on the website is encouraging curious minds and promoting rational inquiry. I mean, how far does this net go?
We're still finding our feet. We thought about using the word skepticism in the title of the organisation, but it's skepticism is a tricky word. We have climate change skeptics and so on, and it's about skepticism, but it's also about science, it's about rationalism, it's about all sorts of things. And I guess over the next year, as we begin projects, we'll begin to define who we are by the projects we undertake.
And do you have any sense of the overall goal yet? I mean, have you thought about what you want to see the organisation having accomplished in, say, a year or two yet?
No. I mean, to be honest with you, we've got two projects just to get us going. One is the Golden Duck Award for quackery, and the other idea is a small grants project to offer to people who have ideas and have enthusiasm and are willing to put time and effort into them, but don't have the relatively small resources that might kickstart that project. So, and Johnny's going to be driving those two forward, the Golden Duck Prize for quackery and the small grants project. He can probably tell you a bit more about those.
Well, we thought we'd kick off with the stick and carrot approach, and the stick in this instance is the Golden Duck Award. And so we've got prizes in the UK that awards good scepticism, but nothing that really highlights quackery and pseudoscientific nonsense. And we're kind of taking our cue from some other countries here. In Finland, they have the Hoo-Ha or the Flim Flam Prize, and the Dutch have the Master Kakaduris Prize, and the Australians have the Bent Spoon. And so we thought that the Golden Duck would just be a good, fun, light-hearted thing to get started here in the UK. And nominations are open now, and so if I can just make a call for anyone who might be able to think of someone who might be appropriate for this award, they can nominate on our website. And the first year we're doing this, it's open to all comers, and so in future years we might concentrate on a specific aspect, maybe politics, maybe medicine, but this time it's for a lifetime achievement. The closing date's the 1st of October, and then after that we want to involve the sceptic community in this award. So once the nominations have been totted up, we'll be sending out the highest ranked nominations to local skeptics in the pubs groups, and they'll be ranking the top five in order and sending their ranking back to us here at Good Thinking Towers in true Eurovision style. And then once we've collated all those results, we'll be in position to announce the inaugural winner, the Golden Duck.
I was going to say, do you know yet when we can expect an announcement of the first winner?
So it'll be in December this year.
Excellent. And we'll put links to for our listeners to go on and find out more and not nominate and so on our website. Now, the thing I thought was intriguing about the organisation was the small grants plan. I mean, what sort of projects can you envisage taking up these small grants? There's I understand there's £5,000 at the moment.
That's right. And looking to maybe roughly divvy that out in £1,000 parcels. But in terms of what we're expecting the grants to go on, we don't really know, but we're really looking forward to find out. We're just really keen to promote grassroots scepticism. And there's increasing numbers of sceptics in the UK and indeed worldwide who are doing amazing stuff on no budget or barely any budget at all. And amongst them, there's got to be people with great ideas, but perhaps without the means to put them into action.
So we're thinking things a bit like perhaps the 1023 campaign, which I know Simon was also involved in.
At the moment, anything is possible. Anything from the UK, anything from overseas. If somebody says, look, we've got this brilliant idea, we've got the people on the ground to make it happen, but we don't, we need £300 to buy this, or we need £400 to do this, then they can come to us. It's a very simple pitch. And the idea is to act quickly, dole out the money in the next few months, and to get some grassroots activism going next year to go alongside all the great stuff that's happening already.
Lovely. And I understand it's not just you making all the calls, Simon and Johnny. It's you've got some prestigious names in British scepticism on the advisory panel as well.
Yes, in fact, it was Richard Wiseman. Professor Richard Wiseman is one of our on our advisory board, and Richard was the guy who came up with the name Good Thinking. We've got people who, well, Richard himself is an expert in parapsychology, as is Caroline Watt. Edzard Ernst is obviously a world authority on alternative therapies. Robert Dugans, who was my solicitor on Sting versus BCA or BCA versus Sting, is on the board. So we may need some legal help and some legal advice from time to time. And Sid Rodriguez, who obviously was, you know, the forefront of pioneering skeptics in the pub. And so we've got a really great gang of people who cover lots of expertise. And, you know, going back to the questions you were asking at the beginning in terms of our direction, our focus, together over the next 12 months, we're figuring out what we're going to be doing based on their input and based on what other people tell us to do as well.
Excellent, and we'll no doubt check in with your organisation. I have a feeling, you know, good thinking will come up quite regularly on our programme in the future. Simon Singh and Johnny Shannon, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks. Cheers.
There was big news in academia this week as loads of students at Harvard University in America were found to be committing plagiarism, essentially by comparing notes on Facebook in what they thought was an open book exam, when they weren't actually allowed to. In this next piece, Drew Ray wonders if the kids who have done this shouldn't be punished, but should in fact be studied. Incidentally, next week we'll have a report from me on the news that loads of students at Harvard University in America were found to have been committing plagiarism, essentially by comparing notes on Facebook, even though they shouldn't have been. In the piece, I'll be wondering if the kids who have done this shouldn't be punished, but should in fact be studied. But for now, here's Drew's take.
If I asked you to name a university famous for high-tech hijinks, many of you would probably say MIT. Based in Boston. Not many other campuses have confined space rescue teams on standby just to deal with student practical jokes. So the highly unofficial hacking guild at MIT was infuriated when their neighbours, Harvard, pulled a computerised practical joke on the entire civilised world by launching Facebook. Ever since, social networking has been synonymous with Harvard. And social networking continued to generate interest this week when a network of student plagiarism was discovered, potentially involving half of the 250 students taking the Introduction to Congress open exam. It's not unusual for cases of plagiarism to be discovered, where more than one student copies off another. To have 125 related exam papers, however, all interlinked by copying, is somewhat unusual, to say the least. Apart from the humour inherent in cheating on a Congress exam, the situation is funny because these students were stupid enough to get caught. In fact, in the arms race between dishonest students and exam invigilators, copying from a fellow student is just about the only cheating method that gives the examiners the edge. Let me explain. From an educational point of view, most exams are a necessary evil. Formative assessment, testing as part of the learning process, is a valuable technique. Summative assessments, finding gaps in student competency when it's probably too late to do anything about it, is more like branding a European Union kite mark onto the student's brain. We enforce quality standards by rejecting the defective brains after they come off the educational assembly line. We'd like to test that the students actually have the skills we want them to have. But we're restricted because we don't really want to spend too much resource on something that doesn't actually help the individual students learn. From an academic integrity point of view, we need to make sure that the student actually does the work for which they get kite marked. The easiest way to do this is to lock students in a room after checking their identity. We prevent them from communicating with each other and with the outside world. They might be able to cheat by smuggling in a little bit of extra information, but it's very hard for them to get someone else to actually do the work. The problem is that this is a very artificial situation, and it probably doesn't test the skills that we're trying to teach. So we make sure that the kite mark gets branded onto the right brain, but what it certifies is that the student is good at memorizing information and writing very quickly. Hence, the idea of an assignment, sometimes referred to as an open examination. Much better educationally, but the opportunities for cheating are many. Here's the easiest way if you're a Harvard undergraduate. You catch the subway, locally known as the T, across to Boston or Northeastern universities, and you pay cash for someone in the equivalent field of study to write your exam for you. You are unlikely to be suspected of cheating, and even if you are, it's unlikely to be proved against you. If you don't have other universities nearby, never fear. There are plenty of online companies willing to produce guaranteed original pieces of work with your name on it. If you're a computer science student, you can even put your programming assignment out for tender. The second easiest way is to use anti-plagiarism software. Yes, you did hear me right. Anti-plagiarism software is marketed almost shamelessly to the students who plagiarize. You cut and paste your work from wherever you please, and then you use trial and error to tweak it until the anti-plagiarism software can't tell that it's been stolen. You're more likely to be caught because experienced lecturers have many more ways of spotting plagiarism than the tools take into account. It will be very hard to prove that you've plagiarized, though, unless you actually confess. There's one catch with these tools, though. They use as input a body of existing work. If you've plagiarized from someone in the same class who submits at the same time as you, the tool won't detect that until after everyone hands in. In other words, it won't tell you that your work looks like cheating, but it will tell the examiner. Just as a quick aside, I'm not giving away any secrets here. Modern students are far more familiar with this stuff than their lecturers, and shining light onto this sordid corner of academia can only help improve things. There's a good reason that publicly announcing the best place to buy drugs doesn't exactly make you popular with the pushers. So anyway, each individual alleged cheater at Harvard probably thought that they were just copying from a friend. The trouble is, their friend had also already copied from their friends, and so forth. Individually, it was discreet. Together, it formed an obvious monstrosity. The social network in action. Now, we don't yet know the shape of the network. Was there an original source, the one true assignment that spawned a class full of lesser copies? Were there two or more original sources with different points of view, and a third source that tried to reconcile them, just while adding a little bit in, and then down through history an unbroken string of shameless copies, each with minor edits? Maybe there never was a single authoritative intro to Congress exam, and the entire class set just sort of co-evolved from blank documents to completed assignments. My suggestion is that we give all of these students a free pass. Undergraduate programs at elite universities are all about cheating your way through life via social networks, and this was really only an introductory subject, so they aren't expected to be experts at that yet. If we give a blanket amnesty in return for participation, we have the seeds of a great research project. All of the textual analysis tools designed to investigate historical work, such as Shakespeare or the Bible, suffer from a lack of empirical evaluation. Yet here we may have many generations of manuscript copying and editing compressed into a short time frame. For extra credit, they might even agree to do it again on their next assignment. This is Drew Ray for The Poddelusion.
This week, Andrew Holding has been up at the British Science Festival in Aberdeen, where just yesterday some new research into abortion on future pregnancies was unveiled. Andrew took the opportunity to talk to the professor who led the research about it, and here's the good news, it basically reinforces the opinions I already had. Here's Andrew, with more.
Today I'm joined by Professor Bhattacharya, who has been looking into abortion. What led you to go and start asking questions about the impact of abortions on subsequent pregnancies?
A number of factors. Firstly, abortions are common. Secondly, most abortions are actually done in relatively young women. Many of these women haven't started their planned families yet. And a question that's often uppermost on their minds is whether the abortion will have an impact on any subsequent pregnancies.
So the metric you seem to pick on was mainly this idea of preterm births. Was there any reason you picked that?
But it'd be difficult to pick something that was impossible to study, wouldn't it? But more seriously, we picked on that because preterm birth is one of the biggest killers of babies and leaves those that survive with significant disability. So if you were to ask to pick one outcome in obstetrics, that's the biggest challenge, it would be spontaneous preterm birth.
In your data, you saw analysing the difference between abortion and a miscarriage, which are obviously two very different things. Yes. Was that just something that was very natural to compare for you, or was there quite a lot of thought before you went down that route?
I think it's very difficult to pick a suitable comparison group when you look at the outcomes in women who've had a previous termination of pregnancy or an induced abortion. That's because those who've never been pregnant at all before, which would seem one of the logical comparison groups, are different because they've never been exposed to a pregnancy at all. Miscarriage covers some of those in the sense that a woman who's had a miscarriage will have experienced a previous pregnancy. But as we point out in the paper on which this discussion is based, there is no ideal comparison group. So therefore, we choose to go with three.
And of course, you got some interesting results. So would you like to briefly sort of tell us what they were?
Indeed. The key results were the risk of preterm birth, and we're talking about spontaneous preterm birth here, after induced abortion, is lower than that after a previous miscarriage, but higher than that in a first pregnancy or a pregnancy after a previous live birth. So that's the first key message. The second is, in our data, we did not find that the risk was increased in women who underwent two or more induced abortions in the past. So whether they had one induced abortion or two or three did not seem to materially increase the risk of a preterm birth in a subsequent pregnancy. And the third is, surgical abortion, but not medical abortion, seemed to be associated with an increased risk of preterm birth in a subsequent pregnancy.
I presume that fact that you've discovered that having multiple abortions doesn't have a cumulative risk is actually a really beneficial thing for people to know.
The first thing is to make sure that people are aware that you need to be cautious with these sort of observational studies because although we think we know the answer, there are issues about bias and confounding, which means the way data are interpreted can sometimes influence the results. So, but it is interesting because you could have thought that having a number of abortions would significantly increase the risk, and we haven't found that. But of course, if you look at the literature, some studies have and some studies haven't, so I'm not sure that we have the last word on it.
And you mentioned earlier was that you looked at the difference between surgical and medical abortions. Could you explain what the difference is and a bit more about that result?
Traditionally, abortions have been performed surgically, which means that without going into too much detail, that an operation is performed to evacuate the uterus. With medical abortion, things are done slightly differently, where drugs are used to open up the neck of the womb and make sure that the uterus or the womb expels the products of conception. So that's the basic difference between the two.
And the results you found suggested that there was more effect from surgical abortions?
What we found was when we compared medical surgical abortion with each other, as well as when we compared medical abortion with women who've never had a pregnancy before and surgical abortion in women who've never had a pregnancy before, that when they went on to have a pregnancy that was ongoing, women with medical abortion did not seem to have any increased risks over the general population without a previous abortion in terms of a preterm birth, whereas those with surgical abortion did. And when we compared surgical with medical, those who had surgical abortion had a higher risk of a subsequent spontaneous preterm delivery.
So do you think something we really need to investigate is perhaps the use of more medical abortions in situations where we're currently going for surgical choices?
I think, first of all, as I've said before, whenever we find these associations, we've got to be certain that we don't automatically jump to the conclusion that these are causal. In other words, we haven't established causality. We've established that the two are linked. So obviously more research needs to be done to see if this can be replicated in other populations. But on the basis of what we found, I think people need to be aware that there is this link, and therefore, if medical abortion is available and is acceptable, then perhaps that needs to be considered.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and been good talking to you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Now, if you were listening to last week's show, then you'll have heard Tom Williamson's piece casting a sceptical eye over the news that apparently using cannabis can knock 8 points off your IQ. Now, I've never used cannabis, which actually makes me more boring than Alistair Darling, of all people. But until hearing this next report, I was cynical about the merits of IQ tests. Because let's face it, it's much easier to write off anything that casts yourself in a bad light. It's for the same reason I don't believe in the so-called theory of exercise, and that Jeremy Hunt doesn't understand the concept of not being a massive twat. Anyway, one of the best things about doing this podcast is having clever people working in a relevant field write in and explain just why something we've had on the show was wrong. And that's exactly what Stuart Ritchie did, so in this next piece, he's going to explain why IQ tests are actually worth listening to.
Picture the scene. You're listening to the Pod Delusion, and in one of the segments, you hear the following. The appropriateness of using evolution as an explanation of human origins has long been debated. In fact, celebrated creationist Ken Ham described evolution as being used for scientific racism. Others believe the theory hasn't moved on since the 1850s and is now outdated. So perhaps evolution isn't the best explanation of human origins. You would, quite rightly, be outraged. Unfortunately, the Pod Delusion from August the 31st actually contained such a poorly argued segment. It wasn't about evolution, though, but instead concerned IQ testing. Like an evolutionary biologist hearing the standard creationist canards, as a psychologist, I hear these claims and cringe. Leaving aside the critique of the particular cannabis study, I'd like to address Williamson's claims about IQ tests. I'll take them in order. First, it's noted that IQ testing has long been debated. This is, of course, true in at least two senses. Scientists in the field of intelligence research debate the merits of particular models of intelligence in the same way as evolutionary biologists argue over, say, the merits of gene-level selection. And of course, like any area of science, a wide variety of criticisms are levelled at IQ testing by people who are ignorant of the evidence behind it. And you do have to be pretty ignorant. IQ tests are some of the most well-studied and validated measures in all of psychology. So I hope you'll agree that these two types of debate in no way imply that IQ testing is unscientific or useless or inappropriate. People do, sadly, bring a lot of preconceptions and prejudices to the table when discussing IQ testing. But a sober look at the science suggests that, in fact, there are individual differences in people's intelligence and that these are measured well by IQ tests. How do we know the tests measure intelligence accurately? Well, the evidence comes from the fact that IQ tests taken early in life are strongly predictive of later life success in a wide variety of fields. Educational and occupational achievement are the most obvious of these, and the most well replicated. But your IQ score also predicts, perhaps surprisingly, your political views and even your life expectancy. That is, more intelligent people, those with higher IQ test scores, are likely to have liberal social views and are more likely to live longer, with an effect size on mortality that's similar to that for smoking. References for these findings are provided in the notes to this episode. So IQ tests are clearly measuring something, and that something is closely related to what is generally regarded as intelligence. But can these tests be used for nefarious purposes, like the scientific racism in the second point of the previous piece, which makes reference to Stephen Jay Gould? It's worth bearing in mind that no matter the purposes to which a scientific instrument is put, it says nothing about the reality of the phenomena being studied. Nuclear fission is real, whether or not bombs can be made using it. And however IQ tests have been used, appropriately or inappropriately, the evidence still says they're measuring something important. There are, unhappily, a small number of scientists who obsessively focus on race differences in IQ test scores, but they're far from the mainstream in psychological science, where IQ tests are used routinely and regularly, and in education, where IQ tests are often used for noble purposes, such as identifying children in need of extra learning assistance. It's extremely difficult to find any scientific racism in modern, mainstream psychological research, which has largely moved beyond the simplistic notions of the early 20th century. Which brings us to the final point, that IQ testing hasn't moved on since the 1950s and is now outdated. Again, this reveals an ignorance of the fascinating research currently being done on intelligence differences. To take just one recent example, a paper published in 2012 in one of the most prestigious psychiatry journals, Molecular Psychiatry, showed that intelligence is related via cognitive processing speed, to the integrity of white matter tracts in the brain. This indicates that IQ test scores are at least partly explained by how efficiently the brain can process information. Papers like this are not what you'd expect if intelligence testing is still stuck in the past. So if IQ tests are measuring something real, and there's such a huge amount of scientific literature backing up their usefulness, why are so many people anti-IQ? A lot of it comes from a straw man version of IQ, propagated by uninformed critics. No IQ researcher believes, for instance, that intelligence is 100% genetically determined at birth. The evidence shows there are substantial influences on IQ test scores from environmental sources, such as education. And no IQ researcher believes that an IQ score is the only thing that matters or somehow sums up the worth of a person. Personality, determination, grit, creativity, insight, and a host of other factors are also of huge importance in making us who we are, and all receive a great deal of attention from psychologists. More opposition to IQ seems to come from an admirable commitment to social justice. Some people just don't like the fact that there are measurable differences in general intellectual ability between people. But here, as always, we should steer clear of the moralistic fallacy. Reality is under no obligation to conform to our moral desires. So, the next time you hear a glib dismissal of intelligence testing, even from someone who's generally well-intentioned and usually well-informed, ask yourself if they're using long-debunked arguments, or if they're speaking from a real knowledge of the scientific literature. It is, if you'll forgive me, the intelligent thing to do. This is Stuart Ritchie for The Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, having learned a lot from the Daily Mail website strategy for attracting more traffic, we're going to discuss women's underwear. For serious. Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to Becky, who has set up a social enterprise that employs the refugee population of Southampton to make pants in a completely ethical way. So I assume Nickelback are banned from the factory stereo. Here's Liz.
Okay, well, the first question for all the listeners would be, tell us a little bit, who made your pants?
Well, Who Made Your Pants is a social business, and we're based in Southampton. And what we do is we turn perfect fabrics that are left over from the underwear industry into beautiful new pants for women, but also into jobs for women who need them.
And on your website, it says you're a worker cooperative. What is a worker cooperative, and why do you set up the business like that?
Well, a worker cooperative is a member-owned business. It means that we are, all of the people who work there are allowed to be owners of the business if they want to be. And anybody who doesn't work there is not allowed to be an owner of the business. So it is owned and controlled by the people that work there. And the reason that I set it up as a worker cooperative is that we are very much a kind of Trojan horse. We're a knicker business on the outside, but we're an empowerment business behind the scenes. We work with women who have had a pretty tough ride in life, and we aim to support them into becoming a bit more independent and a bit more aware of their own potential as humans. So we don't want anyone else to have a say in that for them. We want to give them the opportunity. And for some of them, it might be the first time that they've had that. And we want to say, look, we trust you. We trust your decision-making. What do you think this business should do? So if people go through the probationary period and they prove themselves to be, you know, reliable and everything, then they can be part of it and they can be in charge of it.
There's all the whole hiring regulations in the UK and things, but how do you pick people to work for you? Is there a sort of selection process or a waiting list?
There's both of those. We specifically focus on working with women who are refugees, and at the moment, that tends to be women who are refugees from Somalia, the Sudan and Afghanistan, so places that really haven't got such a good environment for women. And we're very clear, we work with people who've got status in the UK. We don't work with asylum seekers who are not allowed to work. We work with people who are allowed to work. And we initially went out through various agencies that worked with refugees, and we asked them to put us in touch with people. And we now have an enormous waiting list, because one of our workers particularly went through a period of every week she would bring a new friend with her and say, my friend wants to come and work, my friend wants to come and work. So we have a waiting list. We've also got a cohort of women who have worked with us and become pregnant and have gone off and had their baby but wanted to come back after they've had their baby. So we've held their jobs for them. It's very flexible. The women we work with, a lot of them are not used to structuring their time. They might not have ever had formal work commitments before. So we try and be very flexible to allow them to get used to working in a non-scary way. And then when they're a bit used to it, we can start introducing some more employability stuff that would mean they're employable somewhere else in the UK too.
Well, you're hinting at there. What are some of the challenges you face with employing and, I guess, training these women?
Oh, my God, it never stops. We've been doing this 4 years, and just a few weeks ago, one of our women who's been with us the longest changed her shift without telling us or asking us. She sent a message in with a friend. And one of the problems that we've got is that some of them may have had jobs in other countries, but they maybe weren't great jobs. A woman that I know from Refugee Support Agency says these are women who are used to having things done to, for, and around them. So their ownership of their behaviour, their ownership of the consequences of their actions, it's really very different from the way that us in the West understand things to be. There are some huge conceptual differences about the way they see the world that I would not have expected. And two that spring to mind are the concept of exact. So if I asked you to cut a pattern out, you know, gave you a pattern piece and put it on some fabric and said, cut it out, I know that you would cut exactly to the line. We were getting loads and loads of size 8 pairs of pants being cut out and no size 10s, and we couldn't understand why. And it was because it was just a little bit wrong. And that was the quote, it's a little bit wrong. And that wasn't a problem for them. And we've had to explain, no, that's a big problem because that impacts on our fabric yield. You know, we know that so many meters make so many pairs of pants when we have so many different sizes. And the knock-on effect was enormous. The other one is about the way that some of the women we work with relate to information. Again, if you or I were in a room and there's a sign on the wall, you would probably just read it without even thinking you were reading it. You would just know that that information is available for you. You're allowed to pick that stuff up. Somebody said to me once about some of the women we work with, these women might not know their own address because they know how to walk home and they're never going to write themselves a letter. And there's this real kind of feeling for some of the women that information just isn't theirs. It comes to them through other people. And that means that if we put signs up on the wall saying no food in the production room, or if we put a sign up on the wall saying please tell us if you're not going to come to work next week, that just doesn't flow in the way that it might do otherwise. So we're constantly learning about how the women we work with relate to the world and then trying to work with that to teach them how this world in the UK works and how they need to be if they want a job here.
And one of the reasons we thought we'd interview is that you have an interesting fundraiser going off. What is it for?
We are crowdfunding to buy a particular sort of sewing machine and associated designs and training. Now, the sewing machine has a fantastic name. It's called a twin needle cover stitch machine. And we've been told that this machine will allow us to develop very specific sorts of products and do very specific sorts of stitches. It will, we are told, allow us to make men's pants, which is very exciting. So the machine is a certain amount of money, then our designer would make us a design, which would be great. But there's also a chunk of money for training because our team need the training, but they also need fairly constant support while they're learning new things as well. And it would be really great if we could do this, because I tend to use the term Trojan horse about us a lot. We're teaching our team how to sew and we're teaching our team how to make pants. But what we're really doing is we're teaching them to be employable. We're teaching them versatility. We're teaching them that they know more than they think they do. We're teaching them that they can do more than they think they can. At the moment, we've got a very straightforward style of knickers. We call them Amy. It's a lace short. And there are 3 or 4 sewing steps. And it's really quite straightforward for them to do them quite well, quite quickly. We know that if we have them doing that forever, all they'll ever learn is how to do that. And it won't challenge them and it won't push them. We're an empowerment agency, so we know that we need to push people and get them to learn, and we need to want them to try new things. So this new machine will allow us to really push that part of our work.
Excellent. And for people who want to support you, either by buying pants or by helping you fundraise for this new sewing machine, where should they go?
Well, come to our website for pants and gift sets and all sorts of loveliness, particularly, am I allowed to mention the Christmas word yet? Because that's on the way. So our website is www.whomadeyourpants.co.uk. Very simple. And our crowdfunding is being hosted on the BuzzBank crowdfunding platform. And the link for that is www.buzzbnk.org/WMYP.
Great. And we will put all those links on the Pod Delusion website.
Can I just say that the crowdfunding runs until the 9th of September, and any help that we could get in that last little while would be really amazing.
Becky Pence, as I know you from Twitter, thank you very much.
It's entirely a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Remember, do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to very nearly 3 years of podcast archives, as well as loads extra on the Pod Delusion Extra feed. Also on our website, you can find out more about our big birthday event, which takes place next week on Saturday, the 15th of September, at Conway Hall in London. It's doors at 7, starting at 7:30, and it's going to be fantastic fun. It's going to be an evening of interesting things. So do come along. It's only a fiver to get in. It's going to be amazing. You can find links to find out more and to buy tickets at poddelusion.co.uk. And if you have enjoyed the show this week, do head over to our website and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are really hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. It's like buying us a couple of drinks a month, maybe. So do go over to poddelusion.co.uk and do that. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Corey Hazelhurst, Drew Ray, Stuart Richards, Elizabeth, and me, James O'Malley. We did a challenge by Liz Lutton. Skeptical Reads by David Lovesey and Brian Toon. The Pod Delusion is part of the British Human Association.
Ever doubted everything? Even your own doubt? Disillusioned with atheist lightweights? Well, sit back and fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
I've been told, Dave, it's time to man up and sign up to Atheism Plus.
As a member of Atheism Plus, you'll be 100% about everything. Heaven will be nothing more than a UK-based seaside holiday resort.
That's Haven, Dave.
You know full well what I mean.
But I've read it's not for everyone, is it, Dave?
That's right. If when you're asked the question, is there a God, and you reply...
Well, it depends how you define God, really.
Atheism Plus is not for you.
It seems that Atheism Plus is the third wave of fascism. Sorry, I mean atheism. I mean atheism, third wave of atheism.
Of course you meant atheism. Fascism would imply moving towards a totalitarian state that seeks the mass mobilisation of a national community through discipline and indoctrination.
But as a member of Atheism Plus, you are free to believe in anything you choose, right, Dave?
Well, no, it's a bit stricter than that.
Is it?
Well, yes. It's a cross between Richard Dawkins and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Sort of a...
I won't be back.
Approach to the afterlife.
Sort of.
I don't think I can get on board with that, Dave. My dad would go all Old Testament on me if he found out.
Oh, that's all right, Jesus. There's a no-sandals policy at the meetings anyway. You'd never get in.